This episode of the GR Project is brought to you in part by Oaklandish, an Oakland institution since 2000. Oaklandish's mission is to spread local love by way of their civic pride-evoking tees and accessories, while creating quality inner-city jobs for locals and giving back to the people and places that maintain our city's trailblazer spirit. In line with this mission, Oaklandish donates a portion of all proceeds to grassroots nonprofits committed to bettering the Oakland community.
Welcome to the GR Project, an Oakland education innovation podcast hosted by Greg Klein and Randy Weiner. We seek to amplify the voices of a diverse range of educators who live and work in Oakland, California. Their stories are local, but inform national conversation. Our guests' intense personal experiences contribute to perspectives on the purpose of public education, illuminate polarizing assumptions, and challenge common and oppressive caricatures of education stakeholders. We're glad you're here.
Hi, listeners. Some of you may have noticed that we pulled this episode off of our website in the last 24 hours. We did this because some of our female listeners pointed out that my introduction of our dear friend and accomplished colleague, Ms. Medrea Rangel, did not equitably represent Medrea as a guest alongside the three men who also join us for this episode. We could not agree more, and so we're re-recording this introduction right now in order to address that problem. We offer our sincere apologies to Medrea for our mistake. And please, listeners, please keep that feedback coming to help us do even better.
In this episode, we invited some of our former guests, and we're fortunate to have four folks be able to join us. We thought we were going to do some collective reflection and thinking about the recent Oakland teacher strike, but we really didn't end up going there directly.
Guests in this episode include Dr. Brian Stanley, Dr. Charles Cole, Ms. Medrea Rangel, and Mr. Kenan Scott. One great way for listeners to start to get to know these folks is to go back and listen to their full episodes. Briefly, Brian is currently Chief Operating Officer at Hamilton Families, and prior to that was the Executive Director of the Oakland Public Education Fund. Charles is the founder of Energy Converters and produces multiple podcasts on public education and the needs of Black students and families. Medrea recently transitioned out of her Director of Community Organizing role at Go Public Schools and is currently doing independent consulting. And Kenan is an engineering teacher and the manager of computer science at OUSD and the founder of Coded Academy.
Check our website, thegrproject.com, for links to the social media platforms for all of these four guests. Additionally, Charles and Kenton are producing some great podcasts and vlogs, and we'll have those links on our website as well.
Some of the topics that came up in the discussion in this episode include the group speaking to the notion of families of color not relying only on schools, but expanding and clarifying a more complex notion of a commons, a more community-oriented, more community-based way of thinking about how to serve children of color. We also ask guests to think about the timescale against which they're working with respect to their education reform efforts, and we prompted them to think about whether or not it's more difficult to be revolutionary today than in the past.
Randy and I won't be back at the end of the episode to do our regular wrap-up, and instead we're going to just let this conversation end all on its own. So without further ado, we hope you enjoy this episode.
We are ecstatic to have the privilege of these four folks speaking on the topic today. And so what brings us all together is the strike, at least initially, though we are going to try really hard not to rehash or relitigate the strike, because we think there's other places where the energy should be focused. But we'll see where the conversation goes, and I'm sure along the way it will be impossible to not refer back to at least some of what's happened, but our intent here is not to produce the GR Project's version of the post-game analysis of the most recent strike here in Oakland. So we'll see how well we do in sticking to that.
Yeah, and you know, in the last, I think even since the last time we released an episode, there's been a lot of like content and stuff that's happened beyond the strike. There has been a lot of reflection and public reflection, I'll add. I know, so Charles has launched, now you're up to episode 10. What do you want?
On which podcast?
Yeah, could you, there's this new hip podcast, the Eight Black Hands podcast.
Yeah. So I mean, basically, without trying to start a full network, in the last year, I started producing or co-producing three new podcasts. And they're, each of them have different formats. So the Eight Black Hands podcast is a national podcast with four black dudes in education from all across the country, like a panel discussion similar to today. We have the State of Black Education Oakland Rants, so SOBIO Rants, where it's a one-on-one, it's a one-on-one kind of format that just allows leaders in Oakland working with black folks to just have a space to talk about whatever they need to talk about, like with no holds barred, no structure. And that's been really, really good. And then we have our Student Voice podcast, which is our young people. And it's like, it's doing two things at once. It's kind of young people talking about topics in education or whatever they want to discuss, and also a little bit behind the scenes because they're learning how to produce and do their own shows. So I think you were referring to the Eight Black Hands podcast where we discussed the OUSD strike and the impacts, and Dr. Stanley was actually a guest on that episode, and I think it was really informative for a lot of folks. And so I mean, yeah, but this topic has been something that's, you know, been at the forefront of a lot of our political lives. And I think a lot of folks are still recovering from it.
Yeah. So, listeners, if you want, feel free to pause and go check out that episode. That came out, you guys put that out about a month ago?
Yeah, a little more than a month ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's our highest rated show, kind of by far. And the Eight Black Hands have just been asked to do a live show soon, and it'll be in Oakland. Yeah, so that's getting a little bit of momentum, and what we found is when we do our regional shows, whether it's focused on Oakland or Minnesota or wherever one of the hosts lives, it tends to have a significant spike. So, yeah. You know, hopefully we can continue that momentum. I think we've been a little blessed with that.
Yeah. Well, I also want to say, you know, so Kenan's been, I don't know what you call it, but video kind of live blogging a little bit.
I guess it is
blogging. And you touched on, you had a couple episodes about the strike. So if you want to also share a little bit about that, because I think that's also a big piece of the content that folks are producing as they're reflecting on what happened.
Thank you. Just first, shout out to the Eight Black Hands, because that provided me with sanity. Just to have the counter narrative or just an additional narrative that just, like, for me, it was like super influential in just being able to exist at that time. So shout outs to y'all. That was real. My wife, my whole family, everybody's listening to it. But at the same time, I've been doing an awesome YouTube channel called Blading on the Brain. It's about rollerblading. So blading like that, BLADING, blading on the brain. And since I was here last, my life has had lots of ups and downs and twists and turns. And it really journals and catalogs like what it's been like for me after having a traumatic brain injury. I had a really intense injury skating December 2017, where, you know, I ended up with multiple skull fractures, frontal lobe damage forever, loss of sense of smell, I couldn't balance, like it was real. Like, you want to talk about being on the edge of death and coming back from it? I definitely understand that now in a way that I would have never understood it before. And so somewhere around 6 months into recovery, I just like pulled the camera out while walking my dog and was like, let me just like say something to a camera and put it on YouTube. And since then, it's just blossomed. And part of the really cool portion of the journey was talking about the strike, vlogging it like live, like in the middle of it, like where I was at, like how emotional it really made me, what my journey was, like really what my day was like to cross the picket lines. So I had an episode about that, and my wife, she's my angel, she's an occupational therapist, and she helps me like really unpack what that all means from a neurological standpoint. So like I could tell you how it feels, but she's like, all right, this is what's really being triggered for you. And so then we had an episode afterwards. She was just once again just blessed me to come on live and like put her face on the camera. She don't do that at all. And so she and I had a conversation unpacking basically that whole episode, what she saw, what I was feeling, and what I reflected on afterwards as being the real triggers for me, especially as someone with a recovering from a brain injury. Like, what were the real triggers that were hitting me? Like I'm mad about something, but really there's an underlying factor. And that's just trauma response in general, right? So check those episodes out. I think they're just real vulnerable and honest. And that's what I was trying to hit at. Yeah.
So I definitely wanted to kind of begin this episode, which is making sure the audience, we'll put the links, you know, on the podcast description page and all that sort of stuff. But there's a lot of other good reflections and content out there that we want to make sure. And I'm sure we're not even going to assume that like all of us in this room have already all absorbed all of that, because we may not have had a chance to. So, yeah.
So given that we clarified what our thinking was in coming together, we now sort of want to push that aside and ask you. So for those of you who want to comment, what do you feel like has been covered so that we can make sure that we don't go there, assuming that there's general consensus, and if there's not, no big deal, with respect to the strike? And what do you feel, if anything, has not received the amount of tension in any form of media that it should? And then maybe we'll start diving into any of those spots that come up. So anyone who wants to jump in should feel free to jump in. Again, that first prompt is, what do we feel like's been covered particularly well? We don't need to retread.
I'll just hop in and show some love to the people that have been doing the work on data. So if you want to know numbers, go to State of Black Education, right? Definitely check out their deep dive into the numbers that matter, the numbers that count. And then really though, like, friend Stanley on Facebook and just read all of his posts. Like, I'm to be dead honest, like, there's another, like, you know, you need a lifeline when you've fallen in the sunken place, and your boy's posts were like those, like, you know, those quick grips. You're like, oh, thank God. Whoo, I was slipping, but boy, you really caught me there. So I think data, looking at data, understanding numbers, if you really want to check it out, that's been covered. Like, I think that's out there.
You also come for the data, you stay for the fashion commentary as well with Dr. Stanley. But so can you want to just say one more piece about you? The data's been covered. The world knows the story of the data for public schools. And if so, like, what do you mean? What sources and what data for whom? Just say all a little
right.
bit more.
All right. So I'll speak to data around Black achievement in OUSD. That was covered in 8 Black Hands.
Okay.
Right. If you want to know what the numbers are for, like, graduation rates from Fremont for Latinos versus Black folks versus everybody else, go check out the 8 Black Hands podcast. That got laid down. If you want to know what it cost the district to have a strike in terms of money, sure. But really, like, instructional minutes, like what that looks like, go check out the State of Black Education. That data page will break it down for you. That 75,000, almost 75,000 minutes, like.
No, million.
Yeah.
We just laughed at that. But,
oh, I mean, my God.
It's crazy, man.
Absurd. So I think that's been laid down. I think there's a lot of, you know, people who have broken down the budget implications. So you can go look. I mean, like, multiple sides. You just gave me an article the other day, Greg, about, you know, what are the fiscal implications, what do they look like? And also, that's not my bread and butter, right? So I think for that data, I would defer just to others who have really done a deep dive.
Yeah. So I think that the strike surfaced a lot of conversations that we had been kind of pushing off for years around teachers and how much we respect them or don't, changes that are needed in the charter law, all of those. And I think we're not done. I think there's still conversations that we still need to have to complete. So I don't think we're done with any of them. But I do think that we are more ahead of the game in having conversations around how we will honor the teachers in the classroom. And I think the conversation we have not had, which is, what commitments are we now making to our students if we're making these changes? What will we see differently for our kids? How will achievement go up? How will we close achievement gaps? I haven't seen any of that reflected in the conversations around whether it's teacher pay or changes in laws at the state level. And I think we need to start, that's why schools exist. So I think we need to really push on that conversation about how are things going to be different for our children in those buildings.
So I think quite a bit has been covered fairly aggressively around both the fiscal condition of OUSD, all kinds of great reports available on that subject all over the district website. I think quite a bit has been covered about sort of the information about how students are doing, how kids are learning or not learning. And I think we've covered quite a bit about what does it mean for teachers to have fairly low salaries and a fairly high cost place to live. I think the question is, does any of that matter? Because absolutely none of that is new information. None of that is surprising information. You know, we've known for years that at least 75% of African American males that graduate from high school in Oakland are not A through G qualified. We've known all these data points. So it strikes me that the real thing that we've not yet figured out is, what do we do about that? What does it take to make people care enough about other people's children to cause them to be willing to sacrifice something? What does it mean that there's a report that just came out from Innovate Public Schools about, and they do this every year, they do a big sort of analysis of some pretty basic data about achievement across for African American and Latino kids in English and math. And there are not really any schools in the Bay Area that are preparing, that are sort of moving black kids to proficiency in math. What's up with that? If you are middle income and black, your kid is still more likely than not to be something like 40 percentage points behind white kids who are also middle income. So the pattern is pretty well established. It's been established for decades. And the question remains, what are we willing to do to actually interrupt that? Or is this really just a dog? Is really just everyone fend for themselves? I think that's really the question that we've not been willing to come to any resolution on.
Just super quick jump in to say that a number of the questions you just asked, Brian, happened to coincide with where we were thinking we might take the conversation as the conversation went. So if folks are particularly excited about some of those questions, know that I think we'll definitely get there. Charles, if you wanted to jump in, please do.
Oh, I was good. I think they did a great job. I think, you know, I just want to double click on what Kenan said. I think Kenan and a few other people are looking at the achievement data. I actually don't think we've talked about the achievement data nearly enough, right? So, for instance, Fremont has the second most Latino students in our city, right? They had the senior cohort that started in 2017 to 18 had 141 Latino students. 66 graduated out of 141, but that's the number that they'll show as the high school graduate number. You have to dig and find who graduated being A through G eligible. What A through G eligibility means is that you graduate and you are able to apply to a California public college, which is a UC or the CSU system. So out of 141 Latino seniors that started 2017-18, only 26 graduated eligible. So I cannot believe that we've talked about that enough, because it dwarfs so many of the other arguments and conversations that we had, right? Like, I'm not having a charter traditional conversation with you if I'm Latino, like, and those are the numbers that we talking about, right? Like, at Oakland Tech, which is considered the creme de la creme, and I like tech, like, listen, I love all of these schools, and I'm saying this to somebody who grew up in Oakland and went to these schools and who was a student during the first strike, where, you know, and it's well documented, but people seem to forget, there was a big issue between black and brown organizations and the unions in 96 because they were pushing on academic achievement. And it seemed to have been a little bit different where folks were aligned this time. But academic achievement is still kind of at the forefront, right? Like, but Oakland Tech had 135 black kids, seniors, 2017-18, 118 graduated, which is the number that I get reported. Like, okay, all right, you know, it could be a little better, but that's 87%. But only 53 of them were A through G eligible, meaning that only 53 of them could apply to a UC or a CSU without an exemption, without, like, having to appeal or whatever the case
that's
is.
That's not getting in. That's just eligible
Eligible to apply. And when I say that, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with community college. There's actually data that came out that you actually do better if you go to community college first. That's a values call. I'm not having a value conversation right now. I'm having, if our job is to prepare kids for college and career, and the basic, the minimal basic line for that is being abysmally missed. How is that just not like front page news? We can get into all the drama that we want. We can get into who's marching on who and what's happening, right? But at the end of the day, so I want to just double click on what you said, because I think there are some folks, like, we are not academic civilians, meaning we work in education in some realm. The majority of people that I work with, that I spend time with when I'm not on the clock, are not, they're civilians to this work. And so the narratives that they're depending on the media for those narratives, they're depending on their friends who happen to be in education. And every time I talk to them, when they see this, regardless of where they fall on issues, mouths drop. Exactly, right? So, you know, I just want to find a way to actually have this conversation, because I don't see myself as on one side or another side or whatever the case is. This is what we are preparing our young people to be able to do. And then we look and say, oh, damn, why is gentrification wiping all of the black and brown people out of this city? Well, when you raise a generation of serfs that will only be able to do serfdom and to be in service of white folks or new people with money that's coming into the city, that's what you get. So, I mean, I'm going to put the microphone down and
I think that's why I threw the shout out to the 8 Black Hands podcast, because those are the numbers that you guys brought up. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, that's a huge yes and. Mm-hmm. That's not a no but at all. That's a yes and. Those are the data points that I want to talk about, because I was just at a spot where they was fighting for something that I don't even know what they knew about. And the number that came to my mind was y'all got 18% of your 8th graders graduating ready for high school. 18%, lowest in the district, I think. So yes, let's do that.
And I don't want to take up too much time, but I want to say, because in this politically charged time that we live in, if you don't caveat everything, right, like, people take it to mean something else. I love educators. I love teachers. Like, do teachers not get paid enough? Absolutely, they need more money. Absolutely. Like, especially with what it takes to live here. Like, I got a decent job, and I still got hustle economy, like, you know, gigs that I do, right? Like, so these things live side by side. They don't live it's not a mutually exclusive thing. Like, multiple things can be true at once. And so I do want to just say that, like, in Oakland, where it's extremely hard and expensive to live, if you want to stay here and have a decent quality of life, teachers make way too little money. So I did want to just make sure I said that. And we ain't graduating brown people.
There was a lot of head nods here for the listening audience on that piece in particular.
All right, I think there's a strong next step that we can take to build on this. So one of the dimensions that came up for Greg and me when we were thinking through this conversation was that of time. And so, Brian, will you restate the report that you cited? We took a look at this one. I'm going to get the name wrong. The Innovate.
Yeah, I think it was Innovate Public Schools. Right. Like, their annual report on what schools are doing well with African American, Latino children, English and math.
Right. And so one of the if not the key findings, we're just pointing out of the universe of 1,700 or so Bay Area schools. Do I have that number?
1,300,
something like that.
Two are depending upon one's definition, and there's probably room to talk about that. Two are serving black children. 51, these are public schools, are serving low-income Latino children.
And just by serving, you mean?
The California dashboard is demonstrating them as being in an acceptable on grade level or above.
Yeah, and I think and closing the gap.
Yeah. So again, I think there's probably lots of room to dig into what metrics are we using to establish that. But with that as context, and also with context, study that came out a few years ago, but is, it seems to be back in the news a little bit, and back in the maybe the education civilian news, not the, the general news, of the idea that if we stay on pace somewhere between, depending upon who you are, 228 to 250 years from now, we'll close the achievement gap. So taking that into consideration, and if you take issue with that, please, please speak up. And if you want to talk more about that, which it looks like that we may.
Just repeat that number right quick.
That's right. So if I'm not mistaken, and again, please, anyone here correct me where I may go wrong. I believe back in 2016, I'm going to remember the Stanford professor's name, Eric Hanushek, and also, my apologies, a professor at Harvard, put out a study saying that given the current rate of progress or lack thereof with respect to closing the achievement gap, we might expect that somewhere between 228 to 250 years from now, we'll get there. Okay? So... So,
can I say something about that? Because I heard about the Innovate data and didn't get to dive in too much.
Go.
Where I did dive in is to the core data, okay. Right? And so when we look at data, we often look at status, so where they are, and core data, core just released like growth, which we also need to interrupt, is the pace at which we are growing or closing the achievement gap. What I found interesting was that the information on the Innovate site does not correlate with the information on the core site. Whereas schools who are closing the achievement gap don't necessarily make Innovate's list. I think we need to look at both sets of data. The schools are, you know, they're just different.
Yeah.
They're different schools.
And we could definitely have a whole conversation about what do we all mean by status, change, growth, and yeah, for sure.
Well, I don't think it's a theoretical conversation. I think it's like a very real and necessary conversation to have about, I mean, the folks here have a good, at least at Rogers, have a good understanding about what growth means and the need to actually interrupt systems of inequality through measuring growth and how students are growing compared to their peers.
For sure. I think another study that correlates with the timescale on the achievement gap is also like the median wealth numbers of like Black families and white families. That's another one that's like at this pace, it's like 220 some years or 230 years until white families and Black families, you know, on average will have the same median wealth. So that was all setting up a question I think Randy wants to ask, this idea of that sort of time scale. Do you want to?
Yeah. I think there's room for all of you to pursue the points that were just made. And the only context I'd love for you to speak on is, and this is going to sound naive because I'm not going to take a position. I just want, because I don't want to bias the conversation in any way, shape, or form. But if we accept that data with perhaps particular attention to time scale, it seems to me that it's very important to name the time scale against which any one of you or all of us or others in the community in the space are working, because we might evaluate and talk about any particular action in a different way by making plain the time scale we're working on. So for example, my guess would be at least one of you might say 250 years, not gonna wait that long, right? So question right now, just to get us going, is what time scale do each of you feel like you're working against in with respect to the work that you do? Is that question clear?
How many years does it take to overcome racism in this country? And I don't think we need to wait for that. Mm-hmm. I think we need to address these issues head on immediately. And this is also part, this is what you get when you have a racist country. So it's hard for me to name the number of years, because how teachers are interacting with students, how the system interacts with our students and families, and how our government interacts with our students. It's This is education, and we need to address it. And it's also much more of a long game in terms of just changing society. So I'm curious to hear what other folks would say in terms of their own time scale.
So, I mean, I think there was, I forgot the name of the book. It'll come to me in a minute, but there's a book written back, in maybe the late 70s, maybe the mid 70s, on Oakland and Marcus Foster. And in that book, there's some data about what was then the assistance, essentially the reading scores by community in Oakland. And weirdly, Oakland was still just as segregated then as it is now. And so back then, reasonably estimate that, you know, 50-60% of African-American kids were not proficient in reading. Today, that number is something approaching 79%. On one hand, we can agree that public schools need more money. On the other hand, we can also agree that OUSD is a $750 million a year enterprise producing these results. And, you know, I used to think that if we got people the data, they would take action because we're all good people. We care about kids. We care about community, blah, blah, blah. But I'm a little skeptical about that because there is clearly something or some things that get in the way of us taking the type of urgent action. I often said, if white middle class kids performed as poorly in OUSD as black poor kids did, folks would be out in the streets. And so I think it's a question of urgency. I think Maria's question is the right one in terms of how long does it take to overcome racism. But I also think embedded in that is an assumption that racism is part of the reason why we don't take the types of critical action that we need to take. We tolerate an enormous amount of just not very good. Because it's convenient, because it's comfortable, because the conflict is hard, and for many other reasons. But I think at the root of it is there are just some kids who we consider disposable and expendable, and we are perfectly happy to sacrifice them in the name of something greater. And that has been a pattern that has been proven over and over and over again. And every time we think that's not the case, we tend to feign shock and surprise that we get the results that the system is designed to produce. And this is not, again, I will join Charles in some caveating. There are plenty of fantastic educators who fight and scrap hard every day. I know many of them. I've worked with many of them. I've fundraised money to put stuff, to put equipment and materials and supports in their classes to help them do their jobs better. And in the aggregate, that is necessary but not sufficient. And so the types of effort it will take for us to get to sufficiency, again, if we're talking about time scale where we're sacrificing another generation of kids that are starting TK and kindergarten next year to this, that's absurd. It needs to be faster, and it can be faster, but it requires some pretty serious transformational both leadership, not just from Kyla, not just from the school board, but from the broader community of Oakland, because there are some tough things that have needed to be done for 50 years, and the bill is long, and it is expensive, and it is well overdue, and so until we're willing to do those things, then we'll be having the same conversation every year for the next 50 years, and we'll be arguing about growth or status. So we'll be arguing about whose data is better, because those are much easier conversations to have and much more fun and useful than the fact that 90% of black and brown kids in the city are not reading proficiently, are not doing math proficiently, and that is actually the real serious issue.
So how do we get there? How does that happen?
Can I jump in right quick? I'm gonna jump in right quick because I haven't spoke on my timeline, because my timeline, I'm kind of with Dr. Stanley on this one, because like we're parents, right? Like Mirella, you're a parent too. Like we parents in this game, and like to think that I'm gonna wait for change and sacrifice my 3-year-old to this process of waiting is absurd. To think of 200 years, like it's laughable. Anything above, like you're talking above 200 years, that's, I don't see it. My kids don't see it. Their kids don't see it. Maybe the fourth generation Scots from here on out get to see change. That's absurd. That's just absurd. So I think it takes a movement, and I'm speaking to like people that I know understand how important the ability to have choice is, and where you go to school. Like, I know walking up here, I was like, what are you going to talk about today? And I was like, the one thing I know for sure is that if my mom didn't exercise her ability to have choice around my education and where I went to school, I would not be here. Like, shout outs to my mom, right? 31 year educated in the same room, special ed, third, fourth classroom. She never got paid enough. Like, I know that. I grew up with that welfare check. I know that. But what I do know is that she didn't have the agency to do it now for me, then it would have never happened. And so it's a movement. It's a movement about educating people to know that, like, this can't sit for even one more generation of students. TK3 right now, like, TK to, like, come on. If we can't, I'm just frustrated, and I got like all in my feelings, right? Because like to hear that number, you should have seen the meme like face or the emoji face that came over me. I'm like, are you serious? You would even put that out there for people to hear that I gotta wait 250 years to see some change that I know is possible? Because I didn't end up here by accident. Like, I'm not a person with a master's and a bachelor's in civil engineering by accident. I'm not a black male who was an engineer for 15 years by accident. Shout outs to my mama.
So the timeline. Look, man, that's an elegant question. I love the way that you asked it, and I love the way that the people answered it. I do. I love it. It's beautiful. It's beautiful language. Listen, man, black people, brown people, let me just be honest. Yo, you are on your own. When those are the type of numbers that's being spouted at you, like, you are on your own. If we went to another country and we said, from here on out, only 2 out of every 10 of your kids will be able to read, they would drop a nuclear bomb if they had it. But we have a conversation that goes back to racism, which is a real thing. But if my survival, if my kids thriving, if my family, in order for them to have a chance, is dependent on racist people not being racist no more, then let's just take this cyanide pill together right now. Like, I can't think like that, right? And I think, you know, I went to 11 elementary schools. Like, my parents were crackheads. Like, I mean, it is what it is. I live with my grandmother in Kentucky. I lived in Chicago and I lived here. I lived in shelters when I went to school here. White folks was never any equation around what needed to happen for me to not end up in that same type of space as my parents did. And they did the best that they could with what they had. But like you said, they didn't have the agency. They didn't have the navigation skills to basically get me the things that I need. So it took a Herculean effort from other folks. But I want to say this to black and brown people that's listening, because usually we have these conversations to other educators. And I went through this when I was writing my dissertation. Is the academy wanted me to write to the academy, because that's what you do. You write to the academy. And so I compromised. I wrote a little bit to the academy, but mostly I wanted to write to black moms. So every chapter I wrote, I put in front of some black moms, and if they didn't understand it, like, I would go through my chair and make sure it was fine. But whatever word they didn't understand, whatever term they didn't get, I changed it, because it got to be for them, because at the end of the day, Keenan, you're responsible for your baby. Them your kids, you know what I mean? And so, like, and I think it's cool to have this kind of moment, especially in, you know, liberal, left-leaning, loving, kumbaya, we love everybody, San Francisco, you know, racism trying to end here. If it ain't ending here tomorrow, it ain't ending nowhere in this country soon, right? And so that's just what I kind of struggle with. And so the other thing that I just want to say to those parents in that community, though, is that the schoolhouse is not the only game in town for your kid to get the academic and social-emotional well-being that they need to survive. Because this is what people like to throw at me. They say, well, Charles complains so much about the way these schools work for him and all that stuff. And now, look at him. He's a doctor. He runs his own stuff. It's like, yeah, you're not getting the credit for that. I gave my first speech in church. I learned how to be a leader through that church group. I learned how to lead a team when I was at the Boys and Girls Club playing basketball, and the basketball teams that I've been on, the intergenerational mentorships that I had, right? Like, we got to a place where we put the schoolhouse and made it more important than all these other cultural things that we used to lean on as black and as brown people, you know what I mean? And we've kind of devalued them.
So when I got heat for people, I ain't got heat just for schools. I got heat for everybody that's a nonprofit that's getting a break from the government to serve their community. So it's like, yo, Boys and Girls Club, y'all used to be at my school every single day, you know? And they doing that in some schools, but it's like with these schools that's having this stuff, like, where are they at? Where's the YMCA? Where are these coaches? Where are these AAU teams? Where, like there are other things that we have to kind of depend on, because I think that it is foolish and crazy. It just doesn't make sense. If I'm looking at this detached and I'm from a different country and I said white supremacy has ruled that country for a long time and the majority of the teaching force in America is 80% white folks, mostly women, and I'm expecting these white women to love my black baby more than I do, knowing the history that I know. And this is not me, like, again, there are some amazing educators out there, and I think the best educators actually agree with me. I don't think educators, good ones, want you to blindly trust them. I think that they want to go and do their job, and I think they want to create, you know, an environment where you can actually learn. But here's what I'm saying. This is how you show me that we getting over racism or whatever the case is. If we got numbers that say only 2 out of 10 of your kids are actually being able to read and able to apply to these schools, well, then why don't we have, like, these vocational programs back inside of high schools if that's something that we at least are seeing? You know what I'm saying? Why are we not having real conversations where somebody just says, you know what, I love your kid, Kenan, but I just don't know how to educate him. I just don't know, and we got to work together, as opposed to, you know, all these other things that we're kind of talking about. So I don't know, man. I feel like a curmudgeon, and I'm not trying to be. I want to partner with educators, and I do my part. But even when people, when I'm working with people's kids, right, like, I'm telling their parents straight up, like, look, I'm gonna do the best that I can, but at the end of the day, like, I don't know how well I'm gonna be able to do with this, and I'm gonna just keep you in the loop, but we got to be a team around this stuff. And here's the reality, like, every time we fail, we just find a new word to use to soften our failure. You know, I got a friend in my program, and she talks about unconscious bias. She said, well, I looked at a dictionary. Unconscious means sleep. It wasn't an unconscious bias. That was just racist. Like, you just, like, because you saw this data, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, so, I mean, I'm not trying to bust down this stuff and like, act like I'm too good for, like, this intellectual type of conversation that we have. But I'm thinking about my mother at the kitchen table when she was trying to get me into Berkeley High, and my mother, who was already in jail before and was told that if you get caught using the wrong address for your son, you will go back to jail. Mm-hmm. Like, what are we giving that woman? Like, what kind of options are we giving her? You see what I'm saying? And so all this is for, like, that's the moment that I think about when we had these type of conversations. Those are the moments that when I'm getting attacked or getting called, whatever, that's keeping me from putting hands on somebody. Like, I'm thinking about her and my grandmother's memory. You know what I mean? But, like, some of these conversations are just so up here that for the people on the ground that's trying to make it happen day after day after day, it's not penetrating to them because we're not talking to them. And I'm trying to do more of that. I'm not saying, like, I have the answers for that, but I want to just tell you straight up, like, you on your own.
I have a question. I do want to understand this, because I grew up in a family that didn't actually exercise choice,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm here by default.
Mm-hmm.
There are inevitably going to be families in a system like mine who are not choosing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what about them? And I think about my own experience mm-hmm. as a middle-class Latina who went to university, and yet still my children, my son in particular, has faced racism in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I've had teachers tell me things about my son that I'm like, are you serious? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have agency.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
I can actually do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I sit there and I think, what about the kids who are in this school, and this is a good school, quote unquote, whose parents don't have that agency, yeah. right? Is our solution just to arm every single adult in the city with agency? Is that I want to understand, when people talk about mm-hmm. choice, I think that inevitably there will be people who will not
Absolutely.
So what happens to them in that system? What is your solution to those kids and those families?
So, you know, I didn't exercise choice either, right? Like, yeah. I went to the schools that were
you went
in
to Berkeley High.
I didn't. No.
Oh, you tried to.
No. My mother tried to. And I didn't go to Berkeley High.
So there
was
an attempt to.
I mean, she tried, right? But the thing is, so I'm glad you asked that question because, you see, this is highlighted because I felt like that question was going to come. Yeah. And so this is what my study was on.
Yeah.
So my dissertation study, like my research for the last few years was on, it's called Beyond Grit and Resilience. How Black men impacted by the crack epidemic succeed against the odds and obtain doctoral degrees. So basically what we did is we situated kids that had statistically the lowest chance of being successful academically and going off to college and whatever to who rose to gain at the highest level of academics that you could, right? So the theory that came out, well, the phenomenon, it's not a theory yet, but the study found findings that suggest that these Black men who grew up in highly stressful circumstances still experience strong residual effects of their early traumatic experiences, which are exacerbated as a result of the navigational process required of them to achieve high academic attainment success, better known as the Black Achievement Trauma Tax. The reason why I said that is it takes a Herculean effort. Like, we are super resilient. We've been resilient. It's in our blood. Like, you are super resilient and your kid is better for having you. But we all have this level of resilience, but we pay an amazing price for it, right? Like, I'm sure if me and you turn this camera, I mean, these mics off and talked about the levels of stress, trauma, you know, mental health issues that we all face, and we've quote unquote made it, right? Like, so the way in which that we were trying to talk about that was, it wasn't necessarily just around choice, even though choice was a factor for a lot of the subjects. It was the thing that I said, it was utilizing other spaces in addition to that schoolhouse. So think about it like this. We've made the schoolhouse on a map of what's most important. We made the schoolhouse bigger than everything else. We made it bigger than our religious institutions. We made it bigger than our mentorships. We made it bigger than our relationships. And we made it bigger than our community as a whole. But now if you go back and you reset, and you reset them all equally, that means that when that school is failing your child, well, he still got you. He still got the connections that you got. He still got his community of Latino mentors and men and women that you put around him to help build him up, to make sure that both not just his academic is on point, but his social emotional well-being. Yep. So when he faces that racism, because the racism's not going away,
right?
But it's like, now you got the armor, you know how to deal with it, and you know how not to be as traumatized moving forward the way that we had to be. Like, you bear that burden. So now your son can process these things in the process. So think about this. At least your son get to come and talk to you about that. I've seen somebody shot before. I had friends of mine that were killed, that were murdered. I visited both my parents in jail, and I didn't process any of that. I just pushed it down, used it as fuel to keep going. Then you get success, and now you fucked up in the head, right? And sorry, I bleep myself. Yeah. So you know what I mean? What I'm saying is that when we have real conversations with our people, and we're not just holding the school account, we're saying, you know what, this school apparatus is not, some are doing well and some are not. But you know what, where's our churches at? Even if you're not religious, you know the role that the Black church used to play in community stuff? They would be the intermediary between between local government and the people. So if there was an issue with the school district, the church would call a meeting, be in the middle, school district on one side, community on the other side, and they would mediate and they would have these conversations. The NAACPs, like, you know, and we got some of these organizations here, right? Like, think about the Fruitvale and how that got developed. It was because of these Latino leaders that's like, look, we going to make sure our people got something that's strong, that represents them. And when people push them around, we got their back. So it's not a super clean answer.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, we're going to do our job because we work on the education side of things. You know what I mean? But culturally, there are things that we got that have been helping us survive and be great long before this broken system came into being. And, like, people can talk about segregation and all that stuff, man. But what I know from desegregation is that it eliminated a Black teaching force. It eliminated. You know what I mean? And we've never recovered from that, you know? And I know that they're trying to do something with the integration. And like, listen, man, if we keep trying to chase white folks, your money ain't long enough, your reach ain't strong enough, and they just gonna keep moving. So you can move that school, you know what I'm saying? You can try to move those white folks and the people with money into that Black school, and guess who ain't coming? You know what I'm saying? That's why the city is coming back, because they went to the suburbs, Antioch and Pittsburgh, and we chased them. And then they said, okay, thank you for leaving, and now selling me that house back, and now they're taking the city back. So now they're taking the city back, now we want to be back in the city, right? Like, you know, listen, man, we live in the Bay Area where people would love talking about how liberal it is, but we have obliterated the black and brown communities in San Francisco, in Oakland. We supposed to be the most liberal places in the world. We got rid of these people, right? So I know my answer's a long-winded, but I respect your question. Like and I know where it's coming from, and I wanted to give like a real heartfelt answer, even though it might not be sufficient. Did it make sense?
I think what I hear you saying is, it's like, I think as a community right now, the schools are the only commons. Like, we put all of our eggs in that basket. Mm-hmm. And it's not enough.
Right.
And like, we need to distribute the eggs in other baskets so that people see other institutions as part of the commons and place where we can feel support,
right,
and all of that. Yes. Right.
And I
can get down with that.
And I never had choice. Like, and mm-hmm. that's the thing. Like, we never had choice. You know what I'm saying? And my only thing with choice, and I'm not saying that one thing is better than the other one. What I'm saying is, I trust you enough as a parent to show you information and then let you wiggle the way you want to wiggle for your people. So, like, you know, I grew up playing ball. The best way to be in the NBA, to get to the NBA, is if you had a parent that played professional ball. Like, that's so I have friends, like, that are in the NBA and NFL, and they made choices to, like, Oakland has some of the, without having to pay for a private school, if you can go to Mac and ball out in football, or if you can go to Tech or Skyline and ball out in basketball, you have a better chance of being able to go play professional ball, right? Like, that's not my decision to make for those parents that did that for their kids, and those are the best that they made, and Oakland produces, outside of my hometown of Chicago, per capita. No, per capita, because Oakland is small compared to New York and Chicago, per capita, Oakland produces some of the most professional athletes, right? We just saw Dame Lillard, like, on the biggest stage in the world being an assassin, right? But think about where he went. He went to a small school, he went to Oakland High, then he went to Weber State, and so all I'm saying is that that was a path that his parents put him on.
They had to carve it.
Right. You know what I'm saying? And they did what they did, and it wasn't just the school. It was the EOYDC. It was the Rebels that he played basketball for. Like, it's you, when we go deeper into people of color and their success, their academic success and professional attainment, when you dig deeper than the surface, I think my hypothesis is that we will see that it's actually the school probably played a smaller role compared to, like, community factors.
I'm gonna back you up on that, because you just had me do that reflective process myself. Right, because I was thinking about you. Because shout outs once again, as always, to the A Black Hands. Because your last podcast, you really broke that down, your whole dissertation, the whole reasoning behind it. And I was like, yes, for sure. And now you made me even go deeper into my own experience. Because yeah, it is those coaches on my football team. It is the fact that I went to a dancing school for my entire youth. I was at a dancing school, learning how to dance with all types of alternative male black figures for me to, like, latch on to and find mentorship, because my dad wasn't there, right? Like, those are the people that, when I think about it, people are like, well, who was your favorite teacher? And I'm like, oh, I got to think back. But then it'd be like, who was the person that helped you understand what it meant to be a man? Like a full man, like a real man, like beyond the mask man. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like a whole inclusive male. I'm like, it's those alternative father figures that I sought out. That I found as mentors, or that I just listened to a single phrase and it took me, you know, I mean, I'm gonna shout you out as always, because your phrase of the elephant's trampling, right, from Eight Black Hands, when the elephants battle, the grass gets trampled, right?
The elephants fight, yeah.
Like, those are words you take with you, right? that you arm yourself with, that armor that you take with you when you know you're gonna face scrutiny. When you know that when you walk up in the meeting with the gold teeth, they're already going to think some way about you. So, you know, I came onto this podcast, right? And I have some things that I want to talk about, but really I came on because I've been inspired by the other people in this room to keep pushing on, right? And so, like, that's what I mean, like a movement, right? Like, how do we start getting this type of language out there? Like, I'm talking about, like, stupid style, like in the car with the loudspeaker. And the person just drive it around like the Pope Mobile, and they, like, exercise your right to choose, and they just drive around saying that. Or where is the church? Like, what is the community? Like we always used to say it takes a community to build up a strong child, a strong human, but then we forgot what it meant.
Right.
And then that's in the black and brown community predominantly, because I know for a fact where I'm at, where I'm situated up in Redwood Heights, oh, the after school programs are abundant. They cost a hell of a lot of money, But they are abundant. You could go to Sarah Science. You could do Doug's drama and now hip hop camp. Like, you know what I'm saying? I get the flyers all day. And so I know it's out there. And I think you guys talked about it on the podcast, too. It's like, why don't we exercise that right to have these other opportunities for our students so that the commons doesn't just exist in the schoolhouse. And it really does exist in the community. So you feel like I did my thesis, because I'm academic sometimes myself. But my thesis was on why, and I wanted to call it Why We Have Fat Kids, but I knew that was not okay. But that's what it is really about, right? Because I grew up in an age where you just went to the school and played handball or basketball or kickball or whatever. You just went onto the grounds and played. You didn't have to hop a fence. You don't have to get, like, exclusive rights to go use, right? And if you needed that, it went through the police athletic league. So then it was even worse. Because if you messed around in school and couldn't play, and then the cop was mad at you, and then you went and got caught in the street doing something, they knew your mama. Oh, my God. I better be straight up all the time, legit, right? And that doesn't exist now. And so my thesis was all about creating MOUs with 501c3s so they can use school property under the California recreational use law, which is that if you show up to a baseball game and you get hit by a foul ball, you cannot sue the school. You is the inherent risk that you took showing up to the hockey match and getting blasted with a puck. Like, you can't go sue the Sharks. You can't do that. Like, you just can't. It's legally, you can't do it. So you can't go to a school, play on the playground, and then they're all afraid that, oh, if it gets vandalized, they're going to sue us. No. No. That is not true. And so I just wanted to add on, build, because these are the conversations that I think literally need to be pumped out of a speaker right on the corner of International and Fruitvale, just as much as all the other messages I hear.
That is exactly why we wanted to have the conversation. So... The way, for me, in which I'm trying to ask the questions, I'm not trying to dance around anything at all. It's not my intent. I'm trying to be super mindful of how, as a privileged white guy, I do or do not evaluate circumstances that I don't experience. Right. The closest I get is I've got daughters, and so when I think about the idea of my daughters being successful, as a privileged white guy, I'm not interested in a conversation that says they're successful within a white male dominated patriarchy. Like, that's not the game. Those are not the rules that interest me. And it feels like it sells them short and the conversation short to even engage when those are the rules of engagement, right? I am very comfortable confessing on my journey to be a better white person. I just don't know. I'm not as confident about how to express that in a way that lets folks of color believe that I might actually care about being mindful of these things. So my language might be a little more parenthetical and guarded, but that's where I'm trying to go. So if I were to imagine myself as a person of color, Charles, I think I would say exactly what you're saying. And it leads me to where I think the rest of you are starting to go, which is the time scale is totally unacceptable. The system doesn't give us any reason to believe that we're ever going to get there anyway. And so if those two are true or close to being true, are we having the right conversations? Are we thinking about solving this problem within the confines of a system that we all accept, I think, ain't gonna do it, doesn't care, doesn't want to, because it could, as Charles, you pointed out on both podcasts, it just doesn't care. So we're trying to solve a problem for people that we in this room and outside this podcast absolutely view as important human beings. That is not the way, it seems, the majority of people view these children. And so if that is true, trying to solve this problem within a system that fundamentally cares more about dehumanizing than humanizing seems like a total waste of time. Call me out if I just committed a sin of white privilege. I am here to hear that. But what I'm trying to do is engage us in maybe a place, Kenan, that goes right to what you're talking about. this needs to be screamed. What do we want to be screaming, though? And are we living with a form of oppression by even trying to have this conversation within the confines of the current
system?
Well, you're
doing a good job. It's fine. Like, I think that we're having a really good conversation. The only reason I just grabbed it is because, you know, media asked a question, and I wanted to make sure, like, you know, again, like, I mean, it's my nature to just kind of yell and scream and do all that stuff. But I did want to just add, though, right? Like, I mean, as somebody who's worked with you, media, and seen your kids, whom I love, right? And like when I'm in a space with me there, like I think part of that answer is that you need a crew of very different type of personalities that are moving in a similar direction but have nuanced differences, right? So when I'm in a room with me there, like every time I see her, I'm greeted with a hug. Like there's something about her and like her calmness, right? That's like, it tells me without words, okay, I see this armor that you come in with because of how you was, you know, because of who you are. Very similar to like my grandmother, like has a way to kind of get me to hug and smile and like just be kind of in that moment. I think that what I'm saying is I think you need a mixture of all these kind of things, especially boys, like especially because where I came from, my mother, who was very sweet and was very nurturing, was also raising me to be able to survive in Chicago and in Oakland. So there were times where maybe I came in the house crying or whatever the case is, and she wanted to hug and hold and embrace, but she knew that I had to go back outside because them wolves would be ready to eat you. And I think that what Mireya is kind of showing me is a different side too, is like yo, this is that social emotional well-being piece. And I wanted to, one, say thank you for that, because we're not gonna be working together as much, but two, I want to make sure that we made that space for you to be able to, you know, fully get your thought out. Because I know that you had a thought that you were working towards, and I don't know if you got to, put the button on. If you did, that's fine, and we can move on. But I just wanted to make sure you got a chance to finish your thought.
I think I did get it out for the most part. I think that as somebody who experienced trauma, and I know that you did as well, it's my understanding that people process trauma in different ways, right? My brother and I both grew up in the same trauma. I was the one who was like, gotta get it together, do well in school, and da da da. And my brother was like, blah, you know, both same situations, right? And so I aspire for a school system, but now we're talking about a community in which it doesn't matter how you process your trauma, because like some people process it outward, some people process it inward. We're still damaged. Right. And so how do we construct a school system or society where both folks are taken care of? Right. And so I think that, like, you know, some of the conversations that we've had here about like how do people interact with our children is important, in that how do we make sure that even if you're buttoned up and doing well in school, like we can thrive, right? Both emotionally and academically, but also if you're one of those kids who's got that trauma and needs to let it out, how the school system can also support you. Like the first podcast that your students did, the fact that they chose mental health as the first topic, to me, was like, right, of course. You know, that's something that my son talks about. Like, they're like, we are in pain, and we're expected to not be people in these rooms, and we just want adults to ask us, how are you doing? To see us as more than just like academic numbers. I think it's complicated and it has many things, but like I aspire to have the school system that has that. But also what you're saying is let's not exclusively put our eggs in the basket of a school system. Let's think beyond that. And I'm totally down with that.
So I think the question that I heard you ask was, at least how I'm going to answer this question, is I think you actually need both, right? Because you're talking 36,000 children in OUSD, you're talking another 12,000 or so in charter schools, and another 17,000 or so in private schools, and that's a lot of kids. And you know, you need this is one of the functions in our country that government is tasked with supporting, which is public education. It's been that way for since the 18-something or others, and it ain't going to change. Because what existed previously, we no longer have that infrastructure, right? We no longer, there were church schools, there were, like, it was a much different setup that would not necessarily scale to serving 70,000-ish kids across a city like Oakland. So I think we need OUSD to be the best OUSD it can be. And I think that's actually where the fight is. The issue, you know, isn't that black kids can't learn. The issue certainly cannot be that we need to wait until poverty is eliminated, until racism is eliminated, before we can make any material progress in improving educational outcomes for black and brown children. That is, seems preposterous to me. The issue really actually isn't even that we don't have enough money. $750 million is a lot of money. If I woke up with $750 million in my checking account tomorrow, I'd be pretty happy. The real question is one of will. Right, it's not there's not a question about do we know how to teach black and brown children to read. Of course we do. We know precisely how to teach black and brown children to read. The question is, what are we willing to do that? I often talk about my own experience. My kid goes to a school that's a fairly good school, leaders has had fairly consistently good teachers, and this year he started in a class of 30 kids, 26 of whom were boys in fifth grade. It was rough. He has had sets of experiences at that school that have just been jaw dropping. And quite frankly, I have an immense amount of power and privilege and access wherever I enter, but particularly in Oakland Public Schools. And I was stumped several times to know what to do. And a couple of times I'm like, baby, I'm gonna have to teach you this myself because this ain't gonna work. And so he's not gonna go to OUSD schools probably again after this year. And I am not happy about paying that private school tuition bill. Payments will start next Thursday. I am feeling some kind of way about it. But that is a reality. And I think that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I think it's ridiculous that is the system that we tolerate, because that system is getting the results that we as a community are perfectly happy to continue to accept. And I think we have to figure out how to interrupt that. So I agree with the notion of, and I really like the way Monet and Charles really framed this as the commons and thinking about, if all of the primary healthy, intellectual, social development for our children is situated at school, then we're probably overinvesting and overestimating what schools can do. I also suspect that there's some way in which schools probably would actually really appreciate the help. That the notion that they have to sort of provide every human service, and it's not to say those human services aren't essential. It is to say that's an awful lot to ask them to do that. And there are some trade-offs, therefore, that have to be made. Not every teacher should be a social worker. Not every social worker should be a teacher. And it doesn't mean that folks ain't valuable. It simply means that sometimes you got a job and I actually just need you to knock the cover off the ball on that task.
Different
skill sets. And so
it's easier to commit malpractice either way.
That's right. That's right. So I think is a really important piece to think about how we lift that up. It's also a result of the fact the city of Oakland has a structural deficit. Most of our public systems in this state have structural deficits. Most of the government no longer builds housing, which is actually why we look to the private market to try to build us affordable housing in our communities so that way folks can stay here and continue to live in this community, be part of this community. But that's clearly not happening at any pace or scale that is going to meet our needs. We simply underinvest in the public systems that really lots of folks desperately rely on. And so it seems like there's a bigger conversation to be had about some of those choices. Some of it's about taxes, some of it's about tax policy, but quite frankly, most of it is just about priorities. What is the stuff that's important to you as a community, and how do you deploy the assets and the resources of your community to meet those needs? And none of those conversations are conversations we have. There are reasons for that. Sometimes it's because we absolutely disagree with each other and we're not prepared to have that conflict. Some of it is because we actually don't give a crap about the folks that live on that side of the city. They are not nearly as important as people that live on my side of the city. And some of that's because we just don't know what to do. And so it seems to me that sort of collectively there has to be a shift. I don't think there's a universe where OUSD folding up and going away or becoming, 275 separate charter networks is going to produce the types of outcomes that we want at scale for 36,000 kids. I mean, again, I used to, when I was at the FMC, people would come to me and say, I got this great program. Great. How many kids can you serve? I can serve 50. I don't come talk to you about your 50 kid program. I got 36,000 children. You got to move me in chunks of at least 1,000. Anything less than that is just wasting my time and my money. Right. So I feel pretty much that we're talking about how do you get solutions that move things at scale, which really means those solutions need to be pretty clear, pretty focused, and they're not going to do everything for everybody. And I think we have to sort of figure out how we surround schools and communities with the other assets they need outside of the school building that then work together to collectively help move them to a more thriving mode.
I'll co-sign on that.
Oh, I know. What follow-up question do our gracious host have?
We can do a follow-up question, but if you want to say something, Charles,
go ahead. Nah, man, Dr. Stanley is the best at the mic drop moments. You got to be ready when you see him pick the mic up, you know, have your next one in the tuck.
That's absolutely right.
All right, this might seem a little unrelated, and I may very well lose the thread after you all weigh in here, but I think, Brian, you're leading us into one of the other questions we wanted to ask. Is it harder to be revolutionary today than, say, 50 or 100 years ago?
Hardly revolutionary today.
Is it harder to be revolutionary today than 50 or 100 years ago?
Pick 50 seems, I mean, they're random numbers, but 50 seems like it puts a reasonable amount of distance between us and the past.
I mean, I guess, what are you categorizing as revolutionary? Here, the reason why I say that is because I don't know how well you or the folks listening are up on the great Sean Jay-Z Carter, right? But him and Harry Belafonte had like this back and forth, and Harry Belafonte was a little like, you know, he was pushing Jay-Z on some stuff, and Jay-Z said, "My presence is a gift. My presence is a present," right? And so when you say revolutionary, y'all is two of y'all that's sitting across from like four folks of color that grew up in whatever type of environments or circumstances that they did, who are relatively like successful and doing work in like education, right? So when you say revolutionary, like that act of that just existence, like not me, don't put me in this parent piece, but these three people, please stop it. But these three people are raising babies. That's the blessing. Like, that's the revolution, right? Like what Mireya just said around, like, the way that she grew up in trauma and how she utilized that and how attuned she is with her kids, or Kenan talking about the way he's raising his kid, or, like, even Brian just being able to have the agency and the means to make that decision for his child is a – if you said this to, like, somebody, like, 150 years ago that was maybe Latino or Black that was living in bondage – and you said that this would be something that would be happening, or even to my grandmother, right? She get on her knees and like start like speaking in tongues. Well, she wasn't Pentecostal, but she'd be praying. You know what I mean? So I guess when I ask you, I need to understand what you mean by revolutionary.
Yeah, and I would ask you to define it, because I'm certainly not going to presume a definition for you all. So I think when you hear that, the reason why I'm asking is. They're not trying to hide anything, right? Is given Brian's last answer, only because that's most recent, but everything you all have said fits into this. I'm curious about your take, given your definition of revolutionary, whether or not, when thinking in those along those lines, when primed to think about revolution, revolutionary, whatever that may mean to you, are the actions that Oakland or even beyond are taking, do they align with what it means to be revolutionary, with what is possible in terms of being revolutionary today, or potentially calling back to a big point that Kenan made, are we not really shouting as loudly and in the right direction as we should be? Does that make sense?
So for me, I don't think that at the scale of a school system, there is very much revolutionary work that happens. There are some exceptions, but I'm pretty skeptical of that. I think we see revolutionary moments. I think Black Lives Matter had some fairly profound consequences on how we thought about mass incarceration and police relations in communities. There's been some really interesting changes on things like civil asset forfeiture that no one but the deepest sort of civil libertarian nerds ever thought about very hardly, or people who like lost their stuff to the police coming in, breaking down your door, stealing your stuff and claiming it. So I think there have been some moments, but I think in Oakland, I don't actually think much of what our public systems do is terribly revolutionary. And I think revolutionary gets overused a bit like innovation, right? Your innovation for doing the most basic things. It's like, no, you just moderately improving, going from, grand incompetence to slightly less incompetent. That's not really innovation. Like, come on, let's push it a little bit. So that's one part. Do I think it's harder? I think systems of oppression are adaptive. And I think they're smarter than we give them credit for. And I think they are far more insidious and very good at infiltrating in ways that are designed to sort of corrode and blow up what's something that could become transformational for folks. It sort of just gets eaten alive, right? I think of some of the stuff with restorative justice, and there's much about the RJ program that I think is brilliant and beautiful and wonderful, and hats off and high fives to those who have led that work, continue to lead that work. And it's ridiculous that was one of the things that OUSD had to cut, right? Because some time ago, a conversation about what aren't we going to do to ensure that this program is permanently hardwired into what we do here was never sufficiently completed. And then those trade-offs weren't said, yep, we're good with that. And so the city's going to pay for it this year, and I don't know what's going to happen next year, right? And so it becomes a shell game. When again, for a $750 million system. So I think we tend to underestimate that impact. I told someone the other day, I said, when education, and in probably most sort of areas of social concern like this, we tend to underestimate the resistance. We assume that we can walk in and make a really good argument. There's a great book called Just Schools, written in like the early 80s by David Kerp, in which he sort of looks at school integration across Oakland and Richmond and San Francisco, I think in Berkeley and a couple of other communities. And one of the things he comes out with is he essentially says there are some issues that have a sort of moral right component to them. And school integration is one of them. We think school integration is ridiculous and bad and morally repellent, and we should do school segregation, excuse me, is gross and bad and morally repellent, and we shouldn't have sort of that type of de facto segregation of our schools. And so we pass laws, we promulgate policies, but then we forget that there's actually a really complex technical dimension to that type of change. And we fail to attend to the technical dimension of that, right? We fail to attend to the fact that even though we may have you can have the best school choice system in the world. San Francisco article in New York Times just came out this morning about this. You have the best school choice system in the world, the beautiful, most beautiful algorithm. But if a kid can't get from one side of the city to the other, then do you really have a school choice system? Or do you just have some sort of like, weird, cruel, like school hope system? And he's like, those are the types of technical things, right? When we desegregated schools and we essentially put Black children in the 1950s and 60s into schools with white teachers who hated them because they grew up in a context of deep, strong, pervasive anti-Black racism. And you then put those children in those classrooms. What exactly did you think was going to happen? And so I think it is the technical stuff that we often forget. And because we forget that, then whatever revolutionary act, whatever transformational thing, it ain't going to make it. It's kind of almost doomed to failure from the beginning. It's just no one talks about it.
I think my question as I, I'm sitting here thinking about everything y'all are saying, and I'm someone who sits right in the intersection of everything you guys are talking about, because I'm trying to run a very progressive department within OUSD, computer science. And a lot of it is due to the fact that I see the awareness factor being the most necessary component to learning a language and being a part of an industry that is predominantly doesn't look like you. And I just like, I'm thinking as you're talking about how there has to be an interplay, right? You spoke to that, this idea of the commons, right? And so I'm wondering, like, if we know that schools need the support, because as someone who is often in a school, like every day, I know that they need the supports. They will welcome the supports. I understand that even as an institute in this or institution in the center of a community, you cannot make a community change from the inside out, right? You can't, like, schools no longer have the ability to be the beacon that shines out and makes that change from inside the building and then out. Like, I can't expect that my students are going to come into class, feel a certain way because I have high expectations for them. We perform rigorous tasks, and then as soon as they leave the building, they're going to keep that mindset with them, because I know once they hit the community, they're gonna have to flip that switch, right? The lions are out there. The wolves are out there ready to pounce. And so you got to – so then I'm like, okay, what I'm hearing and what I'm thinking is, like, if I got to move 1,000 or more students – And it takes more than just one entity. It takes a full community. Am I starting to think about how to build an ecosystem around specific areas, right? Am I starting to think, like, all right, what are the partners that are already out there? I was just meeting with Stevon from Mission Bit, Stevon Cook. Shout outs to Mission Bit. They work in a lot of our schools, right? So, like, I'm, like, trying to see, like, what is this ecosystem that already exists? And then how do I tap into it to create this community around the school? So students leave, they go to another space that mirrors or at least, you know, excites the same learning, or at least, like, gives them a sense of awareness of who they are and the strengths that they already possess and bring to this. You know, that's what's going on in my mind. Just so people who are listening are like, wait, we haven't heard Kenan in a little bit, because I'm sitting over here thinking, like, big picture, like, how do I sit in the middle, and how do I then use my position to actually leverage change, to, like, push this needle so that in less than a generation or in less than one cycle of a kid going from TK to 12, like, how am I going to do this, right? Because I feel like if the burden doesn't fall on me, but I have to be a part of that solution, part of that movement. So I'm just, to the folks out there, your boy's sitting here thinking, trying to figure it out. I'm in awe of the conversation itself, so I hope y'all are too while you're listening. So keep listening, right? Because, you know, it's about to go even crazier, I bet.
I just think it's a very interesting question. I didn't expect to come here and be asked about revolution. I would, off the top of my head, define revolution as aiming towards a society where a group of people or no person has power over another person or a group of people's destiny. And I think that's going to take a lot. I know revolution does not come from within the government, because the government is constructed to maintain the status quo. Just enough so that, you know, certain people are comfortable or certain people know their place as serfs, etc. And so while I aspire towards a revolutionary future, I know that it's a long road, and like, I have to carve my path of, like, I'm going to do this thing first, and then I'm going to do this other thing, because it takes, you know, who knows if it'll ever, if that society that I'm describing will ever be realized, but it's certainly the one I'm aiming for.
I think, so now that I kind of got a better vision of what it is that you meant when you said revolutionary, you want us to define it. Listen, I think in a space where only 2 out of 10 Black folks is reading proficiently, or 3 out of 10 Latino folks are reading proficiently, or whatever abysmal number it is, I think it's just simple. I think it's us just being able to achieve academically and be okay social emotionally, which will then turn into adults that will be in positions and spaces that will be a part of systems and hopefully interrupt them, such as our prison system or our governmental systems or whatnot, right? Like, and then having, like I said, I really believe that the three parents that are on both sides of me, like, are, that it's a revolutionary act. Not knowing much, I don't know much about how you grew up, Kenan. You can talk a little bit about it, but knowing how Dr. Stanley grew up and a little bit about how Midea grew up, right? Like, we are all, like, one generation away from, like, deep poverty. And I think we are the generation that have, like, jumped a few different, like, income lines and accessibility lines. But social emotionally, we still are actually kind of in a space kind of not quite at 100, but maybe at 60, right? Like, so for me, like, I know, like, all this is still a dream. I've been poor longer than I've had money, and I still don't have that much money. But according to where I came from, I'm doing well. And I feel like white folks is going to snatch it any day now. Like, I just because of the life that I lived and had to navigate to get here, and the way you got to be squeaky clean in this world and in this social media driven, super hyper expressive world. So I'm still not that chosen generation. I think this is, like, I would call this kind of that Moses generation. And I think that there are people that will come after. I think of Brian's kids, who I spent a lot of time with, like, they're just growing up in such a different context. They're growing up in a two-parent home where both of the parents are educators. The financial, like those children are not aware of their parents' financial circumstances. I knew my parents' financial circumstances. I knew what no was. No wasn't because they didn't want me to have it. It's just we just could not have it. Like, I'm from a generation that still knows what government block cheese is. You know what I mean? Like, real poverty. Like, I really depended on the government to live, right? In the wide housing project in Paducah, Kentucky, to, like, the tall, like, projects in Chicago. Like, that's where I lived. And you just lived with roaches and rats, right? And so I think when you say revolutionary, these people stand the course, and they pay, see, I think because that trauma that folks deal with, and that there's an anxiety that I think this generation deals with of adults that doesn't really get talked about, that people don't really deal with in the public, because we come from parents that you don't go out talking about your business and stuff like that. But I think that these folks, I see them actively working on their own social emotional well-being, like, because, like, I got the academic attainment. Now, how do I, like, now not just be paranoid of everything around me? How do I not just live in constant fear? How do I react in this room, and how is it incongruent with how I want to react, and do I get to be my whole self, right? Like, you know, I broke it down on the other podcast, and they was asking me about my goatee or whatever, and it's like, I'm doing that because it don't bother me. It bothers your constitution of what an academic should look like, right? And so, but your kids are going to grow up, like, having a different understanding of what success is. And I think that's revolutionary. And then those kids are going to have kids and children. And this language that Midea is talking about, that Dr. Stanley is talking about, is going to be embedded. And so that's what I see as kind of revolutionary. And I think we're just kind of in that bridge moment, that Moses moment or whatever of that. Like, we might not get there with those folks, but I do have hope for what these other generations are going to have. If we stay strong, though, and keep pushing the line, if when somebody says something about integration to me and I have to fire back and say, look, if that's what you want to do, great. But my success is not contingent on the acceptance of white people or proximity to whiteness. Like, my success cannot be in relation to proximity to whiteness. So I reject those notions and those conversations. And there's a cost to doing it. And, you know, and what that cost means is I might just be doing this for a few more years, and then I might peace out and go back to, like, you know, I talk to Dr. Stanley about this all the time, and I think they think that I'm joking, but a part of me is like, you know what, I put in my years, and I might just end up back in the Midwest on somebody's farm, and just because I feel like I'm owed that. I feel like I did what I needed to do. You know, my grandmother has this thing, and I'm just trying to honor her because, like, that's who made me who I am, even though she died when I was really young. She said, baby, you have to earn death. When my grandmother died, right, like, and she was dying and she was sick, and it was kind of like a let me go type thing. Like, I really believe in heaven. Like, I've been sick here. I've been hurting here. You got to let me go. Like, I earned this death. And I try to live my life in a way like I want to earn my death. I want to put more positivity into the world than things that I've taken out of it. And I've taken a lot from this world. And I deal with that and I live with that. But like, you know, but that's something that I think about. So when you say revolutionary, like, you know, they might not have on a Malcolm X shirt or a Che Guevara shirt or whatever the case is, right? But I think that the three people on my left or right are like, it's the most revolutionary thing you could do is be who they are and reproduce. So I believe it.
That sounds fun. So I wanted to add to that because I think it's interesting going back to kind of the thought of revolutionary. I have known a lot of people who consider themselves revolutionary who lead from their pain. That is not revolution. And I think that's what you're talking about. And as I see sometimes organizing happening in the streets, I see like hurt people wanting to hurt people. Right. And so I think that like I want to agree with Charles where our work as leaders, it is only revolutionary if we're willing to match it with our own internal healing so that we are not perpetuating the same trauma and pain that we went through. And that like we find healing in our whatever form of leadership that we bring to the community, but we also are finding healing and helping heal other people. So I want to appreciate you lifting that up, Charles.
We're gonna send the Charles love around real quick because I'm gonna jump in on that too and be like, revolution for revolution's sake is not revolution. It's not just to stand out there and make a lot of noise. That's not it. I'm sick of hearing about the victim syndrome. Like, I'm real tired of deficit language. I'm like, it's just like, you know, if somebody say they're gonna do it better than you, then why are you not shouting that you do it better than them, right? And so that just, yeah, that gets me all in my feelings. And then I want to appreciate you for just saying this opportunity to provide for the next generation is truly revolutionary, because I come from a family where I ran to first base with my mom. Like, I remember y'all talking about, did you start on first base? You start on second base? Like, when you was trying to get all the way to home plate, where did you start the race? Where'd you start? Was you a pinch runner at third and you just kind of had to trot home? Or did you start at you know, in the dugout and had to get yourself on at to bat and then hit a ball, right? I ran with my mom in the first base. As my mom got her graduate degree, I went to those classes as like a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, sitting up in an art master's class, right, trying to figure out arts integration in education. I was just drawing still life. But I understood what my mom was fighting for at that time, right? Just the same way that you said, I know why the nose came. Like, I understood that, right? And so my sons will grow up with a different understanding of like, A, where they can go. I'm lucky. I'm not the first generation to go to college in my family. My mom paved that path for me, right? So that's when I say I started at, you know, on the way to first base. And so that legacy, right? There was an article, and it must have been you, Dr. Stanley, that said about, you know, middle class black families, you would assume could have the same legacy money rate that middle class white families would have, right? And that's not the case. When you look at what happens to children that grow up in middle class families of people of color, right, they don't just go 80% straight across the line and stay middle class. They, like, most of them dip back down below the line of middle class. And I think that is a revolutionary act to be able to provide. Like, and Jigga Man said it, like, you quoted Jigga Man. I'm gonna quote Jigga Man again because New York is in the building. But like, you gotta pass on legacy money. Like, if you're not passing on legacy money, then you're just passing on the same system of oppression that makes every kid start, your every generation after you going to start at home base or in the dugout. And so I agree with you, man. Like I'm not revolutionary for revolution's sake. I'm not going to stand out there and, like, get me a soapbox and yell and scream. That's not how I do it. But I am going to try to make incremental change with my own family and with the families around me, and that's why I believe in community, right? When I Brian, you live in the West, right? And there's a moment in my own head, right, when I'm like, oh, well, Dr. Stanley live in the West. Why am I up here in Redwood Heights? Why am I seeking comfort in the acceptance of others when I should be building with those I feel most comfortable with in a community that I truly believe exists, A, for the right reasons? If you don't know the history of West Oakland and the movement post-slavery, you should definitely learn about it. Like, that's where I belong, right? So I'm like, I don't know. Your boy got mad thoughts. Your boy got mad questions. I'm trying to start a revolution. I'm trying to start a revolutionary institution of academic excellence that holds students to a high, rigorous bar. And I'm like, man, how do I do it all? How do I do it all? Because I want to. That's really it. Like, it's not how do I do it all because I'm afraid to try. It's how do I do it all because I know it needs to be done. And how do I surround myself with the people that I know going to ride with me and that we gonna ride it till we deserve to die? Because I feel that. Ooh, did I get a Dr. Stanley mic drop?
You did it.
Oh!
You did it.
Let him marinate. Let him marinate. Let him marinate.
Just dancing over here.
I don't know if they'll
What are y'all hearing? Speak for all white people. What is happening for y'all?
We've
all been asked to speak for our race or something.
No.
I'm talking about in life. I'm not saying y'all are doing it. It's okay. In life.
We clearly chose to do it.
Right. We know we don't speak for all black and brown people, but right now, speak for all white people, damn it. What does the white delegation think?
Oh, diversify your bonds.
This is gonna be awkward when this all gets cut. This segment right now.
The two of you are a credit to your race, by the way.
I mean, sometimes you just gotta tell people that they're well spoken. Y'all are just very well spoken.
I mean, I want to
like feel your hair before I leave.
You said, "Oh my God, Solange moment." Why are you caping for Solange over there?
Their beards. Right. I want to feel their beards.
I'm gonna say you said
is this. Are we at the barbecue?
This is like the roast. You started by saying, why is this podcast different from other podcasts? And in the spirit of Passover, I'm a Manish Dana to y'all and bring it over you. Why is this podcast different than other podcasts?
Because it puts out one episode a year. So I don't know if this will be a too jarring of a turn, but we'll just put it out there. Okay. All right, so we were just talking around the idea of being revolutionary, and I had a few ideas that I think are decidedly not revolutionary, but I want to just put them out there, and I was just wondering if anyone wants to pick up on them or run with them, or if it makes you think of other things like that, because I think I'm wondering if there's a little bit of conversation to be had about things we could be doing even prior to the revolution, so to speak, or while we're building a revolution, or that it can still be meaningful progress as we're raising these kids right now. So right now in the system right now, if we have already systematized that there are some children who have certain diagnosed needs, whom we as a system say, you know, the public system can't meet your kids' needs. Here's some money. Go get your need met. Like, that already exists. That exists in Oakland. That exists in special ed law. That already exists. Is there something there about scaling that idea to more children? Okay. Another one that I was just thinking about is we already use non-governmental nonprofits in early childhood, in higher education. Why aren't we using them more in K-12 education, which kind of got me thinking as you were talking about the commons and other things. And then a third one is we've been mentioning private school families. I've got one. I got a kid in private. I got a kid in public. Why? And this might be maybe this is the most revolutionary one. Certainly will make white folks run for the hills or wherever they're running these days.
Moraga.
But why do we let private schools exist? So, all right, that triggers something in Dr. Stanley.
So,
Brian Stanley.
So, I think, so. So, the first one around sort of letting the average state pays, whatever the average state funding level is per child, with that $16,000 sort of go with that kid to whatever school they so choose. Is that your first one?
No, that was like, there are certain times, you know, where a family can basic, with under certain circumstances, if the local system can't meet
that child's
need.
Oh, right, like in SPED, if a kid can't get the services, like the district pays for to go elsewhere. I don't find that one really interesting, so I'm going to skip that one.
Fair enough.
I'll talk about the one with nonprofits. So I now work in homeless services where, in the city and county of San Francisco, my organization, we run shelters and a bunch of other things. And the reality is that that's government work, that the city and county should be running those things. And everyone kind of just agrees with that. The problem is that it is more efficient and cheaper for the city and county to pay my organization 85 cents on the dollar to run that facility and then force us to scrap together the rest of the money to then get to 100%, and even to realizing that the total dollar amount is not actually enough to provide a full, robust service for the folks in the building. That's actually similar to what most nonprofits deal with. Most nonprofits are woefully underfunded, struggle mightily to both attract and retain talent because the pay is low, are asked to do things that really, quite frankly, that's work the government should do. And if it meant that I paid a parcel tax to ensure that those services were better funded, I think we probably would be better off doing that and getting quality outputs and putting the effort in the right places. So I don't actually believe that sort of leaning further into the nonprofit system to sort of provide core social and human services for folks is either something that really should be desirable in sort of a fairly wealthy pluralistic democratic society, but this is a choice that we've made because it feels more convenient and comfortable. And now that folks have become wedded and attached to that system, woe be unto you if you want to take away nonprofit funding that is currently distributed to the government and reallocate that funding by building the appropriate sort of more full service agencies to do that. Folks will fight you in the streets, even though you know you can't really do that job. Like I think of all the nonprofits that work on literacy and reading tutoring. Sorry, I know. Most of those programs aren't really all that great. And most of us who've been on the funding side and most of us who've been working on those programs kind of know that. But there's still 57 of them. Right. And so and all of them are sort of scrapping for nickels and dimes here and there.
Sorry about that, Randy. Randy's doing too much.
It seems to me that's actually the kind of conversation that needs to be had, because that would be kind of revolutionary. If it's like, you know, we're not going to do this way anymore. We're going to sort of show up with the right amount of resources and put it in the right places and really invest in kids moving forward in the ways they need to move forward versus saying, you know, Charles, you should really figure out how to do that you should really figure out how to educate this entire school of children, 97% of whom aren't reading at grade level. You should figure out how to really get them to grade level on like 20 grand. Good luck.
So, right, you're talking about like a fundamental reinvestment in like tier one government.
Tier one supports, period, right. Full stop.
And enough of the layered on tier two, extra, tier three.
Right. And what was your second question?
I don't know if I had a second question. Well,
So private schools are allowed to exist because here in this country, we do not force children to all go to one school. If the state of California said, Brian, you could only send your child to the school nearest your house, good luck with that argument. I think that would end spectacularly poorly for them. Because ultimately, there's a reason why our education systems are decentralized from the federal government, because we believe that societally, if you go back in the good old days, the Baptists didn't want the Catholics teaching their kids. And so local control became something that became really ensconced. Whereas in other countries, the public education is centrally planned. It's controlled from the capital, and you are told what to do and you are told what to teach, and there are advantages and trade-offs with that strategy. That's not how we roll here. Some schools didn't want to. I mean, you see this all the time when schools are like, we don't want to talk about We want to lift up Ronald Reagan as the greatest American ever and de-emphasize Barack Obama because in our community, that's what we believe. Okay, cool. Here in California, that's not how we're going to roll. And so similarly, I think the implication of that belief is that it applies into what happens to your kids. The notion that I would be forced to send my kid to a public school when I believe that school and that system would not meet the needs of my child would be very, very challenging from both a political and a social aspect. And so that's why you have private schools. That's why you allow homeschooling. That's to some extent why you also have charter schools, that those are viable options for folks to try to figure out where can I go to educate my child in the place where they would get, where the education they get would meet the needs that I think my child needs as their parent.
I mean, I don't remember the first question at this point, but say the first question one more time, sir. You asked really like these are big questions, well, man.
I was trying to get at the idea that there's some stuff going on right now mm-hmm. that I think is decidedly not revolutionary,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to know like is there's ways to build on those. So for the first one was around the idea that we already as a society and as a local community have found an example where the public will pay for a child to go and get their services elsewhere because they have certain needs.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what the next step is like, what is so crazy, or is it not reasonable then to say, here's another group of children who is clearly not being met by this system, their needs are not being met by the system. Why not let them also get those dollars and go where they need to go to get their need met?
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't know if that's actually that revolutionary of an act. Like we already do it in some cases. So that was the first one.
Got you. And then it was about the private schools. My master's in public administration, like how governments run and why they do what they do and nonprofits and I think in this place, I think the revolutionary act of building a big bureaucratic like system to kind of keep a modicum of like, if quality is here, it's like kind of like right under quality, right? Like, but those systems were never built to be able to handle swift change, big change all at once. And so that's why they give tax breaks to religious institutions and nonprofits, because the idea is like what Dr. Stanley was talking about was like, we just don't have the bandwidth to do that thing and to do it as well. And we can't be the people that fully fund it because we give you all these tax breaks. You're supposed to go out and get people with money to give you this stuff so they can get their tax break and do this good service. So, I mean, I don't, when we talk about revolutionary of like our governmental system, I don't know if that'll ever happen, because it's built to be a dynasty that lives on even when rocky things kind of happen. So I'm somebody that grew up on welfare. It was around for a little bit. A Democrat came in and got rid of welfare, and then people had to like adjust and make certain movements. But I think that it is tied to your question around a private school. I think we have a private system in things because this is a capitalist society, right? So like, even if you said we're not going to allow private schools, right, people with money would find smart people and say, I got $10,000 for you to come teach my kid X, Y, and Z. And I don't think that's going anywhere, right? So
isn't that called tutoring? I think we have that.
I mean, right. So, I mean, I think people will always find ways, right, to, like, people adapt, man. Like, this is why when we have these conversations about desegregation or integration or whatever, like, these things sound good on paper. It's like, well, if it's poor black kids over there and poor Latino kids over there, and it's white people and black and brown people with money over here thriving, then we just need to just break that up and put them together. Well, people with money got this thing called agency and access. And they're going to say, I'm sorry, you're trying to close you're closing Kaiser what? What's happening? You're moving? Is that what's about to? Oh, guess who's not moving with you? You know what I mean? I'm going to go and build something somewhere else. You know what I mean? And I think that, like, people can say a lot of different things. I think that the Bay Area is big on rhetoric. We are so smart. We are so smart here, like, and we can use such big words, and we can use rhetoric
you
and all
say
that time.
We are well spoken.
Yeah, very, very well spoken. Some of the best well spoken white folks in the land, right? And so
you're quite eloquent yourself, Charles.
I appreciate that, right? Right. But what you got to look at, man, is actions. Right. You got to look at what people do. And the best thing to look at is people's budgets and what they do with their own kids. So we can talk a lot of this stuff, man. But if you're not creating a system that you want your own kid to be in and that you would trust with your child, then that should tell somebody else something. You know, when I look at when I'm looking at nonprofits and I'm giving them a judgment on how well they do, like they're going to say they value X, Y, and Z. I don't really need to see a mission statement or your vision statement. I need to see a budget. My values show up in my budget. Like, if I don't have a line item for that thing, so we talk about how much we love, you know, RJ, restorative justice, something that we talk about we love. And I think it's a very popular thing in the Bay Area to say that RJ is just working hands down, this, down, the third. And I hear a lot of people say that until they kid get punched. They kid get punched, and I don't know if I want to have a circle right now. If you beat the hell out of my kid and my kid came home bloody, I don't know if I want to have a circle, right? But we don't have that real conversation on airways like this, right? We have them when the door is closed and after we kicked all that rhetoric. But if we really believed in RJ the way that we say we do, then it's like a major line item. Like, it's not up for discussion in the union talks. Like, it's not up for discussion when we're, like, going through strike negotiations. Because guess what? There were things that you couldn't touch in the negotiations. Guess what wasn't one of them? Oh, RJ. Right. And so then, like, let's have this real conversation. Let's really educate civilians on education here, right? The city said, we will vote on this thing one time. And what went over people's heads, or a lot of people didn't pick up on, is that the city, some of them did not want to do it, but they also, and they did it with a caveat and said, listen, this is the only time we are going to do this. And we are the kings and queens of, like, these one-off payments, and we start programs off of one-off money without a real sustainability plan. But because we know it's going to make people happy, because we know it gives us another year to kick the can, because I know that I might not be in my position again next year and I don't really have to deal with the fallout of it, then let's go ahead and do it. Because guess what, this strike wasn't new. This didn't just happen last night. This didn't just happen under Antoine Wilson or happen under Kyla. It didn't just happen under Tony Smith. These are conversations in a proverbial can that's been kicked since I was a student in this district. I'm 35, fam. And that's the thing that you want me to just blindly drop my kid in and trust you with. Listen, when I say that, I worked in a district. I love the district. I will do almost anything for the district. I will show up. I will serve. You know what I'm saying? But make no mistake, right? Like if you just read the words that are being said and go deeper than the headline, like, you start to ask a different set of questions, right? So the future of RJ, we'll see what happens. And we'll also need to see, I would also love to see, as somebody who does support RJ, I do want to see, like, the achievement data attached to RJ. Like, is there, like, and it might not be academic achievement. Maybe it's the social emotional wellness thing that we're talking about. But I think we're at a place now where it's like, now show me those numbers, right? You know what I mean? And I think that as long as we kind of just settle for things making us feel good as opposed to, like, being sustainable, I'm just really glad I don't have children.
So,
I'm just saying, I feel for y'all. Like, how do y'all balance this? How do y'all balance this? I'm good.
So, something Randy and I have talked off air on is this idea of, and I'll put it in the form of a question because you just brought up this idea of the data around any particular lever we might want to pull on. Where are you seeing any examples locally where the data is front and center as part of the decision-making process?
So it's my understanding that the district is starting to work on one-pagers because I think you're right. I think, like, our budget, we haven't identified a handful of priorities. We have, like, 100 priorities, and we're trying to fund them all with, like, a hairline budget, right? But I think that the district is talking about moving towards one pagers, where they have every program having a one pager saying, like, here's the mission of this one, here's how it's related to LCAP, here are outcomes, here's how much their budget and all that. I think it's the beginning of the process. I think we're, you know, years behind getting to the place to where we can make informed decisions about what needs to be cut. It's not just RJ, it's all of the programs in our district that should be, we should hold them to a level of scrutiny. And we should fund them. We should, you know, fund the ones that we think are working and defund the ones. And we don't have a sunsetting process right in our district for programs that don't work.
I mean, I think one of the challenges is we tend to forget that schools are, the public education is a political system. And there's actually a great book that talks about the American education political system. And one of the points the author makes fairly consistently is that political system is essentially, you have a political system when you're asking a government entity to make an authoritative decision about the use of public resources, right? So the assumption that those resources are scarce, which means that you have people who agree, people who disagree. And when you have all those things there, you have a political system. And so it doesn't really matter the program. In every single solitary school system certainly in this country, if not on this planet, every program has advocates and has detractors. And when you come for that program because I need that $3 million to do something different with it, you have to decide your pain tolerance as a government body, right? The school board has decided its pain tolerance. How much are you going to have people up in your grill saying, how dare you hate children because you want to close this school or cut this program that is transforming the lives of generations of young people? Whether or not that's absolutely true is completely irrelevant at some level. It is difficult, nay, impossible to create a type of culture where the data drives that decision first, because the responses aren't based on some type of sort of deeply hyper-rational analysis. Is based upon this thing that I love. It's based upon that this thing is a part of a community I care about. It's kind of why whenever we talk about school closures in Oakland, immediately people say, well, you didn't have enough community engaged. I'm like, that on what planet does a community voluntarily agree to eliminate itself from existence? That's insane. No one's going to do that. And so there's some challenge that has to be unpacked if we want to try to interrupt that. Otherwise, you just end up with what you have now, which is $750 million is not enough to provide the basic level of education to ensure that black and brown children attain some base level of proficiency in math and English. Like, I'm not saying that they got to be able to code. I ain't saying they got to be able to, you know, to fly to new planets and discover black holes. I ain't saying any of that. Writing and math. And we can't get that. And that's not just Oakland. That's Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley, Fremont, Hayward, California, Florida, New York. It's a whole country. And so it just strikes me that a piece of it is our inability and our unwillingness to make the trade-offs that we need to make so that we can just focus on the most important things first.
Okay, so here's where I get confused. Couple things, I think. So over the last 30 to 45 minutes probably, you've all spoken in different ways to your thoughts really around human nature. So Maria, you talked about your definition of revolution, and if I remember correctly, it was along the lines of no group of people exerting power over another. My bias towards that is I feel like I am hard pressed to support that in human biology. I'm not asking you to respond just yet. I'm just putting that out there. That also feels to me like if the time scale for change associated with that, which I think you acknowledged as well, feels long. I would say it feels particularly long next to some of the other comments that have been made. I feel like Kennan and talking about a generation from now, things being better for the kids, I think I understand. I'm calling out. It is confusing to me because it also feels like it is on a timeline that doesn't feel acceptable to, I think, to you and the rest of us in the room. So I'll just stop there to keep it concise. I think I'm confused about the description of the circumstances, the options, and then what seems like a much longer timeline than anyone is willing to accept. So can you guys speak to that?
Yeah, I think you're confused. So thank you for saying that. But I think this confusion though comes from two different conversations that happen at the same time. Cool. And I think that there are folks that are working towards the future and reality that we want to have. And there are some of us that are operating in the world that we live in. And I saw this a lot in academia, is there were a lot of people, great people, building for the world that they want to live in. I think that's a beautiful thing. And I think that I take the world as it is and try to survive in that. And then, you know, how do I make it better for other people? And I think that when those two thought lines are happening concurrently, the language sounds like we're both answering the same question. So in this conversation today, I am in the reality of now. I am like, yo, this is what our history has been. This is what I'm seeing in numbers. And this is me, whether racism goes away tomorrow or not, like, this is what I need to kind of survive. So I think that, and I think that some folks are also saying, even in right now, is like, no, we can be better. Like, we actually can be better. We can do better. And we do that by holding people accountable and moving systems forward. And I think that that's where the source of that kind of confusion came from a little bit. So my answers are, not to be a curmudgeon again, I'm going to, two truths are going to live here in my answer. I believe in service. I do love OUSD and Oakland and any apparatus here that's doing well by kids and trying to do better. I think that there's a lot of people that care a lot on either side of all these issues. I believe that. I strongly believe that. And what I also believe is that history has shown me that this will not change, not overnight, not in time to save those that are in seats now. And potentially not in time to save the little ones that these folks next to me are raising. So with that context, under the worst case scenario, what needs to be true? And what I feel needs to be true is I think it has to start with you in your home saying, look, regardless of what's going on outside, this is how you gonna be okay. I think it is parents, regardless of their level of education or academic attainment or money that they bring in, saying, I am the expert on my child and you're going to respect me as such. I think it is saying that work to make your school better, because data does show, my data actually shows, that when parents advocate for academic achievement in front of their child, actually has a huge result on how that child performs later in life and if they go and attain college. And I'm saying that schools are not the only game in town to make sure that your child is okay, both academically and with social well-being. Mm-hmm. That is, those are the things that I believe, and that's all the stuff that I'm holding. I can't really, maybe if I had some more time to think about it or sat down, I could bow it a little bit better. But those are all the things dancing in my head, and those recommendations that I just gave out to parents listening. Is, you know, I mean, that's kind of my final thought that I'll leave it at, because I know I got to go to a meeting in a second. Yeah. But that's so I don't know if that's still as confusing, but that's how I was looking at it. And that's when you said that you were confused. That's how I was like, that makes sense that you're confused, because if you're talking about a best society possible and I'm talking about the society that I got to live in, that I've seen kill black folks and not care, you know, that's just how I am forced to think. But the beautiful thing about it is that a lot of young people now don't have to think like that. They are thinking about what will be better, right? And I think, you know, I said that about RJ, and I want to talk to David Usum because I respect his work. But I actually have seen just the presence of RJ actually have an amazing impact on young people, because young people are the people that came out and fought the hardest for it. And I thought that that was beautiful. So that in and of itself is a super strong data point to where we might need to continue to have that. And maybe there's some tweaks that go into that. So I guess that's my thought. Thanks, Charles.
Just to add on, I think there's also that duality that Charles spoke to. I'm thinking of a systems level, how long that will take. And then I'm thinking in my home, what do I hope to see from my own family? And so I think that's exactly my point that I had, Charles, is that, yes, I'm thinking in two time frames almost, because I know that there's a big systems change that has to happen outside, inside. But I also know that I'm not going to wait for my kids.
I think it is called ed reform, right? I live in the world where we are, in essence, trying to reform a system, right? Whether it's in my home or whether it's in the organizing I do, you know, where it's like we are trying to make things better for kids right now, and that is important. There's urgency, but I refuse to live in a reality where I can't have revolutionary imagination. Because if I don't, then I will be okay with individuals being dehumanized for decades. The act of sitting in a circle and restorative justice, I think that is revolutionary. That is bringing us back to thousands of years where our people would sit around and tell stories and learn from that and have a different set of commons that we would learn from. I think that's revolutionary as well. My daughter, for example, when they first started RJ at her school, she was like, I hate it. Now she's like, I love RJ. She declares that at least once every 2 weeks. So whatever is happening in those circles is really powerful. And I want to lean into that and also not give up on the fact that, like, our kids need to know how to read. Our kids need to know how to have mathematical reasoning and logic so that they can create a new reality that my imagination is thirsty for.
Dr. Stanley.
I mean, that was perfectly fine to let my have a mic drop moment, so I think I'm just gonna let that stand. Go on, Queen. Hand your business.
We could go for another 2 hours, no problem, but we won't. So I think we'll leave that as the last word. It's our honor and privilege to be in the room with you all. And thank you so much for your time, your passion, your expertise, your lived experience. I'm also confused about whether or not I should be trying to be well-spoken or not after this. I'm going to have to do some follow-up to get clear on that.
But can you all just keep your podcast going? Can you not?
Yeah, I mean, really, can we talk about
like,
that?
I mean,
y'all got to get some shows with you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great podcast.
All this equipment, you got the computers and the microphones. You just stick it in the closet somewhere 9/10 of the year. I don't make no sense. One episode a year? Come on.
White people aren't exactly very timely or on time.
World is rough today, boy. You know what it feels like, don't you?
Now when I offer if you want to touch my hair, you does that help? The podcast lives for sure. No worries there. And I think there's no acceptable excuse. Thank you for those kind words. I don't know that we warrant them, but thank you.
We're done, y'all. Thank you.
Peace. All right.